The BBC presents My Word. And here to introduce the program and the panel is Jack Longland.
My Word is a word game played by people whose business is words, and those taking part are Anne Scott James, Dennis Norden, Tillis Powell, and Frank Muir. Round one tries to test respective vocabularies. 2 marks, they get the meaning of these words right. We begin with Anne Scott James. Anne, what is a dry bob? Or if you prefer it in 2 words, you can have it. Dry bob.
It takes one back to, not my school days, but somebody's school days, that sort of rather quiet, remote, rather little-known school in the provinces called Eton.
Yeah.
The boys in the summer are divided into dry bobs and wet bobs.
Why?
And the dry bobs play cricket, mm-hmm. which is fairly awful, but the wet bobs, poor suckers, row.
You're absolutely dead right, and it's 2 marks, and it comes from that curious school near Slough, Eton, and dry bobs, the chap who plays cricket. Frank Muir, what is or are virginals? V-I-R... like virginal with an S on the end.
Phrasing it very carefully, I'd say they are pianos that have never been played. They actually, I think, precede pianos, don't they?
Yeah.
And before pianos, there were spinets
yes.
and virginals and square pianos. And I think square pianos were spinets and or virginals on legs.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them, or both of them, I think virginals were didn't have legs. They're quite small, oblong things that mm-hmm. you put on something, such as the piano, to play.
Well done, Frank. That was a very erudite answer. 2 marks. Dillis Power, what is the meaning of dolichopodus?
It's something footed.
Yeah.
It's a very long word. Long-footed.
Absolutely right. Dolichopodus means having long feet, like one of Villon's girls, Bertha Bigfoot, in that lovely Ballad of the Dead Ladies. Dennis Norden, what is vivisepulture?
Sepulture is a tomb.
Mm-hmm.
And vivacious... It's a tomb with neon lighting. Some kind of lively tomb. That's all I can get.
I think what's lively is inside rather than outside.
Buried alive.
Yeah,
that's a good idea.
Yeah. Great,
well done, yes.
But with Edgar Allan Poe rather makes one think of.
Yes. That's it, yes. Fall of the House of Usher and all this sort of thing, yes. Vivisepulture means burying alive, which is a fairly nasty sort of thought.
When you were very young, used you to think and worry about this a lot?
I
did. Yes. It was yes, my kink, you know, when I was 8.
I had a different kink when I didn't. No. I'm sorry. That was when I was 9.
All right. Before we begin round 2, I give each team a quotation for them to write down, and with luck, the 2 women members of the teams will go on studying those quotations, because I shall ask them where the quotations come from at the end. Anne Scott James and Dennis Norden, your quotation is, marry in haste, repent at leisure. And Dillis Power and Frank, yours is, where my caravan has rested. And then at the end of the program, I shall ask Dennis and Frank to give me their idea of how these came to be said or written. Round 2 is a round of odds and ends. 2 marks for correct answers. Anne Scott James, a play with a controversial theme entitled The Children's Hour, written by a well-known woman writer, was made into a film under another name. Can I have the name of the film and the name of the writer?
The writer was Lillian Hellman.
Yep.
But that was the writer of the play, whether she wrote the film, I don't know.
Children's Hour.
I'm going to remember.
I don't remember what
they. And when it became a film, it was called The Loudest Whisper. The original play, and I suppose the script, I don't know, of the film, was written by Linnean Hellman, and the theme was homosexuality. Frank Muir, what is a witch's Sabbath?
A witch's Sabbath? It's a sort of mothering-in-law Sunday. It's what the Germans call Walpurgisnacht.
Yeah.
It's the night that all the witches and their covens come out and...
They meet a particular chap.
Is it Beelzebub?
Yes. Okay. All right. 2 marks it is. Witches' Sabbath is a midnight meeting of demons and witches and sorcerers, and it's presided over by the devil. And it was supposed to be held annually as a special kind of orgy. There have been some indications that things like this are still going on, but I'm not certain whether they guarantee that the devil will personally attend these days. 2 marks. Dennis Powell, why did Mr. Pickwick come to find himself in the Fleet Prison?
Because... Mrs. Bardell? Bardell.
Mm-hmm.
Mrs. Bardell. Mistook or was persuaded to mistake his intentions when she fell into his arms. Mm-hmm. And she then brought a breach of promise against him, mm-hmm. and he said, the hell with you.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Good enough. Yes. 2 marks it
is. Well done, gal.
Mr. Pickwick refused to pay damages awarded against him by the courts in the case of Bardell versus Pickwick. Now, Dennis Norton, in Roman times, what law was known as the Storks Law? S-T-O-R-K-S. The Storks Law.
It was a law against overpopulation in which everybody was obliged to stand on one leg. Like a stork, you see. And thus... more space was created between people. Would you know that there used to be, in British film censorship, there used to be a law, which I think Dillis will vouch for, that if a couple were shown in bed together, the man had to keep 1 foot on the ground. Right. And this led Fred Allen, a great American humorist, when he read about this, to remark that sex in England appears to have the same rules as snooker.
Oh, storks were lucky and you weren't allowed to shoot them. How about that?
I don't know.
I think one out of two for ingenuity and effrontery. Storks Law was a law that obliged children to maintain their aged and needy parents when they became old. And it was supposed to be an imitation of the stork, because the stork young are supposed to look after the old birds. I haven't been able to check this with any ornithologists, and I expect a most frightful postbag as the result. Anyway, that was the Stork's Law.
By a stork.
Well, in the next round, I give each member of each team a quotation and ask them to try and add the next line or two. 2 marks if they can finish off the quotation, and 2 marks for saying author and poem. Anne Scott James. No longer mourn for me when I am dead, then you shall hear the surly, sullen bell give warning to the world that I am fled from this vile world with vilest worms to dwell.
But it's a Shakespearean sonnet, and I can't
yes.
finish it. Can you finish it?
There's another line about when I'm compounded with clay,
mm-hmm.
or when I with clay am compounded, you know, one of the...
Yeah, that's later on. Yeah, this doesn't follow immediately.
I don't know how it goes on at all.
Clay, not Jan Cassius has a lean and hungry.
Two and a half. Because you knew some lines that come later on. It is Shakespeare, sonnet number 71. No longer mourn for me when I am dead, then you shall hear the surly, sullen bell give warning to the world that I am fled from this vile world with vilest worms to dwell. Nay, if you read this line, remember not the hand that writ it, for I love you so that I in your sweet thoughts would be forgot if thinking on me then should make you woe. And it goes on with the line a bit later that Dennis quoted. 2.5. Frank Muir, rather different. He has many friends, layman and clerical. Old Foss is the name of his cat. His body is perfectly spherical.
And he wears a bifurcated titfur.
Nearly, yes.
He wears a runcible hat.
Yes, quite right.
It's Lear.
Mm-hmm.
Edward Lear.
4 marks it is. Now, dear Lisbeth, there has fallen a splendid tear from the passion flower at the gate. She is coming, my dove, my dear. She is coming, my life, my fate. The red rose cries, she is near, and the white rose weeps, she is late.
Well, it's Tennyson.
Mm-hmm.
It's come into the garden, Maud.
Yes.
He gets a bit overexcited.
Yes,
at
this he does. Point,
and tenors shriek a bit.
Yes. What was the last bit?
White rose weeps, she is late.
I don't know.
This is Come into the Garden, Maud, by Lord Tennyson. The red rose cries, she is near, and the white rose weeps, she is late. The larkspur listens, I hear, and the lily whispers, I wait. Now, Dennis Norden, there are men in the village of Erith whom nobody seeth or heareth, and there looms on the marge of the river a barge.
Where they're pewting a television theory.
We want to point your barge in a particular direction. What do we have to do?
You steer it. Yes, that's right.
All right. Get up the sharp end and steer it.
All right. I don't know what to mark you.
A lot.
Two and a half. I think.
Give me goods instead.
This is anonymous, and well might be. I think it's early 19th century, and it runs, there are men in the village of Erith whom nobody seeth or heareth, and there looms on the marge of the river a barge that nobody roweth or steereth. Well, now we come to the last round, and we go back to those two quotations I gave the teams earlier in the programme. 2 marks, Anne Scott James. Can you give me the origin of the quotation, marry in haste, repent at leisure?
Well, I think it's a proverb.
Mm-hmm. Do you know anybody who quoted it?
Every father and mother has said it to their son and daughter about to get wed.
Mm. I think that's good enough. I think you'll get your marks. It started as a Greek proverb, I think. It's quoted in 1566 by a chap called William Painter in a book, Palace of Pleasures. Comes in Congreve's The Old Bachelor, and that ubiquitous American Benjamin Franklin used it too. Now, Dillis Bauer, can I have the origin of your quotation? Where my caravan has rested.
Well, it's a very sentimental song.
Mm-hmm.
Where my caravan has rested.
Do you know?
That's right.
Da, da, yes. Da, 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 da,
da. Is it flowers?
Da, 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 da.
That's it. It's all good.
Jolly good.
It's a 19th century song, Where My Caravan Has Rested, Flowers, I Leave You on the Grass, and it's by a chap called Edward Teschemacher, which is a difficult name.
Assumed name.
And now I'm going to ask Dennis and Frank to give me their explanation of how these quotations came into being, and on this occasion the marks will go to whichever incredible explanation gets the longer applause from the audience here in the theatre. And so we go back to Dennis Norden and his quotation, marry in haste, repent at leisure.
When I joined the RAF, I couldn't help but sort of shrug modestly when they said to me, ever done any flying? Little did they know, they were talking to a chap who'd played one of the lead parts in Peter Pan. And when I say one of the lead parts, I mean a star part. Wendy. Of course, I was only 11 at the time. I don't mean the time I joined the RAF. I mean at the time I played in Peter Pan. It was a council school, and my class, Mrs. Henley's class, had been called upon to do the play for the school prize-giving day. Now, we didn't actually pick Peter Pan. What we picked was Desire Under the Elm. In fact, we'd been rehearsing Desire Under the Elms with some enthusiasm for about 11 weeks before the headmaster happened to drop in to see how we were getting on in the middle of the seduction scene. And he rather sort of blew his top and said, I'm not having this. He said, you'll do something much more suitable. You'll do Sir James Barry's play, Peter Pan. Now, there were only 10 days to go before prize-giving day, and it would tax the resources of the old Vic to put on a production of Peter Pan in 10 days. But nevertheless, we did it, and we licked the whole thing, except for the one rather essential ingredient of Peter Pan, which was the flying bit. Fortunately, we had a chap called Johnny Winkler, who was a bit of a whiz at scientific things, and he fixed up this device, which went up over the rafters, down, across a pulley, down to me. I was in a kind of harness. And he didn't get it perfected until the day before we were due to go on. It was a great moment when they strapped me in this kind of thing, and he went to this wheel that he had, you know, and everybody's sort of murmuring, you can't send a kid up in a crate like that, you know. And he wound, and strangely enough, it worked. Up, 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 I went soaring. It was the most marvellous sensation. I could look down, I saw all my mates about 30 feet below, everybody was cheering, everybody thought it was wonderful, and we knew, you know, it was a blend of sensations. This was going to thrill the audience, and it thrilled me, and it was marvellous, and Johnny was receiving congratulations from everybody. And I said, fine, all right, let's get on the rehearsal, pull him down. So he turned the wheel the other way, and nothing happened. Well, he kept on trying for about an hour. And still nothing. Now, I must point out, this was a rather high school hall. I was about a foot below the rafters, you see. Finally, we had to send for the headmaster, who was livid. But really sort of vivid livid, you know, because he said, get him down at once. Sir, we can't, sir. Sir, we don't know how to, sir. Sir. So somebody said, shall we send for the fire brigade, sir? And he said, no, don't. Go and get the long ladder from the caretakers. And please, sir, sir, the caretaker's gone home, sir. Sir, he won't be back till tomorrow, sir. He said, very well, he'll have to stay there all night. So I had to send for my mother, you know, came and saw her boy, 1 foot below the rafters, 30 feet in the air, you know. And she carried on a bit. She said, what's he going to do about his supper? Because my mother's one of those people who think of all emergencies in terms of food. And she said, I've made him chicken soup and fried meatballs. Well, they solved that. The chicken soup was put in a bucket, and by using the school hose, which we had for firefighting drill, I managed to acquire the soup. Now, the fried meatballs, we had this netball team. And they sent for this girl who was called the shooter. You know? And she was pretty good. See, I got most of them in the mouth. But there I was all night until the caretaker arrived the next morning. I think I soloed for about 14 hours altogether. Of course, as far as the headmaster was concerned, he cancelled all flying for that day. No Peter Pan. And, of course, it was his fault, purely because of the haste in which we had undertaken this production. And it was possibly the best example of a very old theatrical warning, which says, Barry in haste, repent at leisure.
That's the only production of Peter Pan over the Elms that I've ever heard of. And now we go on to Frank Miller's quotation. If you remember, that was, Where My Caravan Has Rested.
Where my caravan has rested. Yesterday evening, about quarter to nine, I was taken with a desperate and urgent need for a walnut and a pair of braces. But looking through the window, I could see that the ginger cat from next door was in amongst our cabbages. Now, I found the walnut quite easily, left over from Christmas. But where to find a pair of braces quickly? They've rather gone out of fashion. Thought I immediately, mind racing, the cupboard under the stairs. Everything is in the cupboard under the stairs. Rushed in. Suddenly I was overcome by a feeling. It's rather difficult to describe. It's not unlike bashing your top of your head against a gas meter. When I recovered consciousness, I'd forgotten the reason I'd gone into the cupboard under the stairs. But I decided to look around while I was there for two reasons. One, because old junk is always interesting. And two, because I closed the door behind me. And cupboards under the stairs always only have a lock on the outside. So I looked around, there was the usual stuff, and underneath was a box. And I suddenly realized that in that box were all the old inventions I'd invented. They were the ways, years ago, when I was going to get rich, when I was going to make my pile. And inside the box, there was a padded cloth ashtray with a sort of 6-inch circle of dress elastic at the top, one side, and a little lead weight at the other. I thought, now, what was that? What was it? Then I remembered. The elastic went round your head. Do you remember when you're young and running for a bus? The bus stop is about half a mile down the road, and the bus is coming from the other direction. And as you run, you keep looking over your shoulder to see how far you... Well, eventually you bash into a lamppost. And this is an ear guard. It's held by elastic round the side. The little lead weight keeps it hanging over the air. And as you dash along, seeing whether the taxi's coming or the bus is coming, and when you hit something or somebody, it protects the ear. It's rather clever because you could unhook it with a popper and fasten it the other side of the elastic for use on the continent. Then I picked up another thing, which was an old rusty electric fan. And all the rust was dropping off and forming a pile on the ground. It was so old and oxidized. And just in front of the fan were three nightlights. And then these tubes leading away. I suddenly realized, I remembered what my invention was. You know why, what it's for, of course. I mean, you've really got to think. Dinner parties. Curry. Now, you know, when you have a very hot curry, the back of your neck goes very cold and wet. Well, when that happened, I was going to start up my electric motor. The air would go over the nightlights, and warm air would play along these rubber tubes, which I'd hand to the guests. And the warm air could then be played over this cold sweat on the back of the neck, you see. It was marvellous. It was the answer to hot curry dinners. And there it was, rusting away in this box. And I thought, well, that's my hopes. I'd hoped to make a pile of money. And that's what I've ended up with. And I thought, what a marvellous ballad that would make. You know, and looking at the little pile still trickling onto the carpet, I thought to myself, I know the first line. Where my curry fan has rusted.
By your vote, Frank Muir wins the contest of the two stories, and the entire contest of My Word, he and Lillis Powell win by 2 marks, and that brings to an end this edition of My Word.
In My Word, you heard Lillis Powell, Anne Scott James, Frank Muir, and Dennis Norton, introduced by Jack Longland. The programme was devised by Tony Shryan and Edward J. Mason and presented by the BBC.